Greetings and welcome to today's call with Baron Funds, a primer on SPACs. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. If at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, please press star zero. As a reminder, today's call is being recorded Tuesday, January 12th, 2021. I would now like to turn the conference over to David Judas. Please go ahead, sir.
All right. Thank you, Carlos. And good afternoon, everyone, and Happy New Year. On behalf of Baron Capital, we hope that you and your families are healthy and staying safe. And I want to thank you for your interest and your trust in our and thank you for joining us on today's educational call, a primer on SPACs. Our speakers today are co-CIO and Baron Small Cap Fund PM Cliff Greenberg and Assistant Portfolio Manager David Goldsmith. And my name is David Judas. I head up intermediary sales and national accounts here at Baron. I'll be your moderator for today's call. Please note, very importantly, there are slides on www.baronfunds.com for this call. I would ask that you take a minute to pull those up. If you go to baronfunds.com, top of your screen, you'll see insights and reports. If you click on that, scroll about halfway down on the left, and you'll see a primer on SPACs. And right there in the text is a link within the paragraph there to these slides. There's about 10 slides. So I have to read some additional disclosure, but if you could please go there and open the slides, they will be referred to during the course of the conversation. If you'd like to ask a question, you may submit it to questions@baronfunds.com during the call. For any more information on Baron Small Cap Funds, ticker BSFIX, or to read any insights from Cliff, David, and all our other PMs, you can visit our site, baronfunds.com. And note, we'll be hosting regularly quarterly update calls with Cliff and David February 23rd and other PMs throughout the month of February, so stay tuned for those as well. We'll get more information out to you on that. If you'd like to have CE credit for this call, you could send your Baron contact, your SEMA ID, and zip code, and we'll submit that request for you after your attendance call. Before we begin, I must read a short disclosure statement. Investors should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses carefully before investing. Baron funds are described in prospectuses containing this and other information, and please carefully read them before investing. Performance is no guarantee of future results. Portfolio managers' views are not intended as recommendations or investment advice and are subject to change any time based on market conditions. Okay, well, good afternoon, Cliff and David. You got
cool.
All right.
Hi, guys.
Thanks for joining us today to discuss SPACs or special purpose acquisition companies. You got started researching and successfully invested in this alternative to the traditional IPO several years ago, well before other active managers, I believe. So I thought it might make sense to kick it off. Maybe, David, can you give us exactly what is a SPAC?
Sure. Just to level set everyone before we get into the meat of the presentation, I'm on slide two. A SPAC is a special purpose acquisition company. It's a publicly listed company where a sponsor raises a blind pool of capital and then has 2 years to find a private company with which to merge and take public. And I find the name Special Purpose Acquisition Company a misnomer because the sponsor is actually merging his business into a private company, typically owning around 35% of the pro forma business. So when a SPAC proposes a merger, shareholders can choose to participate in the merger or redeem their shares. If a SPAC fails to complete a merger within 2 years, it liquidates and returns funds to shareholders with interest. It's very rare that this happens. Only 9 times since 2015 has a SPAC liquidated. A key feature of a SPAC is that they're sold as units, so shares and warrants. And the warrants are detachable, meaning they can trade freely in the public markets. And the mechanics of a SPAC is the pricing is level set at $10. So the warrants typically strike or are in the money at $11.50. The sponsor's role is to generate value for shareholders and partners by sourcing, structuring, and transacting at an attractive price. The key here is that the sponsor needs to convince the market and their constituents that it's a good deal that they're acquiring. Following completion of the transaction, the SPAC structure dissolves, and the acquired business operates as a publicly traded company, just like any other IPO or publicly listed company. So what you'll find is 2020 was a banner year for SPAC issuance. Just looking at the chart on page three, 2020's issuance dwarfed that of the past decade, surpassing the total over the last 9 years. $84 or $83 billion, and I'm turning to slide four now, were raised in 248 SPACs. That was half the IPO issuance, which is pretty amazing from where it came from many years ago, where it was only 10%. So again, if you see the chart on the right, the proceeds equal 50% of the total IPO. And what you saw is as the market began to recover from COVID in the second half of 2020, the SPAC issuance really increased. And you see that in the bottom left chart. The average enterprise value of a lot of these SPACs ends up being $1.4 to $1.5 billion, which is right in Barron's small cap sweet spot for investing. And SPACs on their own have increased in size. In the past, they were very small issuances, $10 to $20 million. But this year in 2000, or in this past year in 2020, the average is $250 million. So they've really gained acceptance. And as again, the charts show, are a main part of market issuance. So why is that? There are a couple reasons we think. The first, there's more well-known sponsors participating. You know, the likes of Goldman or Fortress or Oaktree or well-known recognizable CEOs or investment management heads like Phil Ackman, Cliff Robbins, Sam Zell. And public valuations are high and the markets are hot. And this coming public through SPACs is a quicker and sometimes easier way to get public versus an IPO. And there have been very successful investors on the front end who invest in these SPACs have done well, with limited downside, with potential really strong ROIs. And while the SPAC structures might still be a little flawed, which we'll discuss, they've really improved since the past, where you've seen the industry or the issuance riddled with losses and high fees and a stigma attached to them. That's no longer the case, we think.
Great. Dave, maybe I could just jump in before we turn it over to Cliff. Thanks for that. A lot of good information. I just want to remind folks who may have joined late, we had a large number of people dialing in at 4, and it took a little while to get you in, so we apologize. But the slides we're referring to, the slides are on barronfunds.com. Look for the Insights and Reports section in the center top of your screen. You click on that and scroll down on the left, you'll see a primer and SPACs with a link to the slides we're talking about. So with that, maybe Cliff, do you want to comment on key participants in the SPACs?
Sure. Hi, everybody, and appreciate you all hopping on this call with us today. Just to reiterate some of the things David was saying on page 4, last year about 250 SPACs raised money. 64 of those actually found acquisitions or targets and closed those deals, and there's another 184 of them that have the money in the bank, as David mentioned, on average $250 million, some of them up to close to $1 billion. And those 184 SPACs are out actively searching for targets, so we'd expect that this year amount of SPAC closings are going to accelerate pretty dramatically because there's so many vehicles that are kind of half pregnant. It also shows on the bottom of page 4 how much the pace accelerated during the year, in that the fourth quarter was almost half of the issuance. 132 SPAC IPOs took place, and $40 billion is raised, which is about half of what was done over the year. And so far this year, there's still a lot of demand and a lot of more SPACs coming public. David touched on a few of the key reasons why we think so many of these vehicles are coming public. I'm now on page 5. David made allusion to this, but yes, all the major investment banks are now involved in both the front-end IPOs of the SPACs and helping find the acquisition candidates and close the deals. That includes Goldman and Morgan and then some kind of specialty banks like Cantor and BTIG, who have a great presence in this space. The SPAC sponsors include a wide array, a a wide range of very successful CEOs or business owners, and also many private equity fund managers. Many of these entities actually have done multiple SPACs. Some of them are, have done over five SPACs. So these are, serial issuers or serial acquirers. Most all financial sponsors are participating in this too, interested in selling their companies or bringing their companies public through merging into these SPACs. So most all the fine private equity companies that would usually use an IPO to get public are now accessing SPACs. And many sophisticated long-only investors and family offices are now playing as investors in this space, including us. Our logo is first and foremost on slide five. So let me just explain again some of the basics of this on how this works for the and how a SPAC actually, the phases of a SPAC. A SPAC will raise money in an IPO. As David mentioned, an average $250 million, but now we're seeing much bigger transactions. And then that SPAC will initially start trading and usually trades around its issue price. Those SPACs have, as David mentioned, 2 years to go find a target or otherwise they liquidate. Usually the SPACs are able to find a target within a year, and honestly one just found a target within 3 months. Once a SPAC goes out and finds a target, they usually have an investment bank contact key investors like ourselves that will introduce the target to us and invite us to consider funding a PIPE or a transaction of to put money in alongside the initial SPAC to help close the acquisition. And about three-quarters of the time these days, a PIPE is done also. It's done for a couple of reasons, to raise additional capital if the deal requires more money than was originally raised in the upfront IPO, and also to try to bring some institutional credibility to the transactions. And that's, often we are asked to participate in these deals to kind of give almost like a stamp of approval that an institutional buyer has looked at it and wants to put some money in at the same terms. Once a PIPE is arranged, the deal is in essence consummated between the SPAC and the target company, and that's when it's publicly announced. And at that time, very often you start to see the stocks start bouncing around. Especially if the acquisition or the target is in a hot sector. PIPE investors usually invest at $10 a share, but sometimes post-announcement after the PIPE is arranged, the stocks will trade higher. And then the third phase is the de-SPAC, which basically is anywhere between 3 to 6 months after there's a deal between the SPAC and the target. There is a shareholder vote to approve the transaction. As David mentioned, these votes almost always pass. Shareholders have the ability to redeem or to keep their shares, and also, as was alluded to very often, the people who put money in the IPO are interested in selling their shares either back to the company and not participating or selling them into the open market and holding on to their warrants that they got in the front end and playing it that way. But once the deal is approved, then the SPAC, in essence, converts into that company and trades under the symbol of the acquired business, just like any other IPO would go. So just so you kind of understand, the three different stages of this. For the Barron Small Cap Fund, we primarily participate in stage two. In other words, we're not investing money in the IPO before the SPAC sponsor has identified the target. We prefer to invest money after we are shown the target after we're given the ability to do due diligence and do deep research on that company and decide if we find it interesting. And if we do find it interesting, we'll either participate in a PIPE or buy shares of that SPAC in the open market. So we usually come in that stage two. Just to kind of explain the advantages of a SPAC versus an IPO for the different constituencies. For the sellers, the people, the private equity firms or private businesses that own these businesses in the first place, they love these a SPAC transaction because it's fast. The money, in essence, is already raised, or the bulk of the money is already raised, so they don't have to go on the road and raise it. And there's a certainty of closing because, in essence, they have a deal in hand and most of the money is already lined up. Sellers like it also because they can negotiate the selling price. On an IPO, you're selling a very small piece of a company, and then we'll see where the company trades thereafter to understand what the value of the business is in the public markets. But in a SPAC transaction, a bigger portion of the company trades right up front. And therefore, the seller has more control on how his company is valued. And then good sellers also like the idea of aligning with high-quality sponsors who can help their business go forward and also have much more flexibility in providing long-term financial projections. When a company goes public via an IPO, it can basically through the company itself can't, but through its an analyst and this, you know, kind of a derivative, they can put out short-term financial projections. But if a company comes public through a SPAC transaction, the company itself can kind of lay out its plans for the next 5 years or so, which is an advantage, especially in some complicated transactions. For the sponsors, this is a great deal, of course, because they're basically raising capital and putting up just a modest amount of money for the ability to, if they find a company that the markets approve the deal on, they can earn a significant amount of equity, and therefore sponsors love this idea. Many sponsors, the good ones, will maintain a significant role in that company go forward, assuming board positions or sometimes being executive chairman or in a few occasions actually taking over management of the company. And sponsors also like the idea that if they have a successful deal, that investors like ourselves would like them and they could have the opportunity to do additional transactions. And for institutional investors like ourselves, the advantage of a SPAC versus an IPO is that we get to see a company kind of early in the process and spend maybe 3 months to kind of do due diligence and understand the business, which is a much longer window than we'd have during versus an IPO. We can actually invest significant amount of money in that transaction in the pipe or just by buying shares in the open market. For instance, in a hot IPO or an IPO where there's a lot of interest, the Barron's Small Cap Fund makes investments of $5 or $10 million. And then very often those stocks will trade at much higher valuations, and therefore if you want to invest more money, you're doing it at worse terms. But in a SPAC transaction, we typically invest anywhere between $25 and $50 million in these transactions, all at the initial going-in price that we think is appropriate. And also, sometimes we really can play a very active role in structuring the deal and affecting the terms of a deal. David and I recently just signed up a transaction in which we're making an investment in a SPAC called Juniper, which is buying a company called Janus International, which we think is a really neat, attractive company. But what we decided was, we basically went to the sellers and to the SPAC sponsor and said, we love the company, but we think we would make a significant investment, but only if we were buying it a little cheaper than how you're offering it to us, and only if you raise less money in a PIPE, and only if the money that you raised went to repay the debt of the company first and foremost so that the balance sheet of the surviving entity was proper. And we were able to, in essence, extract those terms and therefore not just invest in an exciting business, but also invest, in my mind, at a really favorable price. Davey, why don't you explain how SPACs have done this year, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, now I'm turning to slide 8 if you're following along. 2020 has been a strong performance for SPACs. And as you can see from the first little chart that 2018 and 2019, the median share price was actually under that $10 level. So we would have lost 24% in 2018 and 17% in 2019, but 2020, that's the reverse. People are making really good money investing in SPACs. And 40% of the deals closed in 2020 are up over 50%, which is just an amazing figure. And these are catching the minds and attractions of retail investors, the Robinhood effect or Tesla or what have you, that some of these companies are coming in really exciting future and speculative but really exciting markets. Some of these SPAC deals are in sectors such as electric vehicles. We've looked at 10 or so in that same space. Online gaming, drafting off of DraftKings. Company called Skills is listed below as an online gaming company. LiDAR, or again, playing off EV, is this autonomous driving, which could be the wave of the future, and a lot of businesses are lining up to attack that market, yet are nascent in their development with very little revenues, but projecting big ramps in their businesses. Alternative energy and space exploration, too. On one of the headliners of SPACs early on was Virgin Galactic, with a strong following and really cool idea to bring passengers to the tip of space, albeit maybe even for 3 minutes. So again, this page presents a very positive view of SPACs, but from the beginning of 2019 to the first half of 2020, if you looked at the SPACs group, that cohort of 47 SPACs in general, they were actually down over a third from their listing price. So the top performers are a very small percentage of the whole, but yet really making up some big returns. And so given that context, I think turning to page 9, our performance has been quite impressive. Barron's Small Cap has invested $317 million in 10 SPACs over the last 2 years, which is now worth $612 million. And so a cumulative return of 250% or annualized 91%. And so you can see from this chart in the top half that we've invested in 5 in last year and 5 this year. So our hit rate is very low, compared to the 64 that were closed. We're really picky and choosy about which ones we invest in. And it's, it aligns with what we try and do in any company, find those great assets that can grow with strong leaders, can layer on a recurring subscription or revenue model, and with high margins, and can really accrete over time. We can be long-term owners of the business, not renters of the stock. So just a flavor of what we've done. Clarivate is a data asset and analytics tool company serving academia, the government, pharma, and legal communities with a very strong recurring revenue model. Number one share led by a really strong leader, Jerry Stead, who was a public market CEO in the past. He was a chairman of the SPAC when we initially signed up, but saw the opportunity is so great with this company that was a orphan from Thomas Reuters, mismanaged, that he stepped into the CEO chair, and along with Michael Fine, who was the M&A banker, the sponsor, brought this company public in a very large SPAC at the time, which we participated in, and it's been a tremendous investment. The deal that was struck at 12 times EBITDA when we bought into it is now trading over 20 because Jerry has brought his business acumen and past expertise to increase organic growth, make enormous M&A acquisitions that weren't contemplated initially, and improve margins. So it's really been a successful one. I'd just like to call out another one is Utz, which we did earlier this year. The stock is up 81% since June, and again, it kind of checks those similar boxes of the chairman who was involved in the SPAC. Roger Deramidi ran Pinnacle Foods, and he's bringing that same playbook to this salty snack company, which is a 100-year-old heritage brand, 43 years of consecutive sales, but maybe undermanaged with Roger at the helm and a really sharp team from Blackstone. They can grow sales or increase sales organically, improve margins from the low teens to the mid-teens, and do M&A. And, you know, our flavor from speaking with them was that M&A would be a big part of the story. And it's just amazing that we thought the $125 million of EBITDA would be $135 or so next year, 2021, and longer term could be $200 million of EBITDA. Well, given they just did two major acquisitions and that $200 million of EBITDA is going to be achieved next year. So pretty amazing, you know, 6 months out of the gate for that company, us. And
Dave, I hear that pretzel brand they bought in Chicago yesterday is pretty great also.
Yeah, well, that's the good thing about this one, Cliff, is we can do our own due diligence on the brand. So, why don't you take the bottom bullets, Cliff, and walk through kind of how we're investing in these?
Sure, guys, we're on page 9. As I kind of mentioned before, I just want to reinforce this point that Barron really will only invest in a target. We'll only invest in a SPAC after the target is identified and after we have conducted extensive research and because that's how we think, you know, we can best replicate the success we have in our basic portfolio. To me, this is just an extension of how we find ideas or new ideas through the IPO market. In addition to the 10 transactions that we show in the chart above that David was referring to, we have committed to do 2 PIPE transactions that will be closing sometime in the first quarter, the Janus International deal I mentioned before, and another company called E2Open, which is a really neat software company that we're very excited about. This is not lost on the other funds at Barron, which also are participating and investing in SPACs. And the other funds at Barron have invested about $180 million in a dozen additional SPACs on top, other than the 10 that we've invested in. And those investments are worth $290 million or so. So the other funds at Barron are also enjoying great success in this channel. Some of the other funds in Barron invest in earlier stage companies and or will invest in the IPOs. So each of the PMs has kind of their own what will do what they think is best for their fund and what they're most comfortable with. So how we're going about it is not necessarily the same as how other funds are viewing when it's appropriate to make such investments. But the success is across the board. I'm now going to wrap up with some observations and conclusions on page 10, and then, you know, we'll open this up for questions, and I think we have a bunch of them, which is great. First point is that, you know, SPACs are a legitimate way to go public, and we believe that they will become more and more mainstream. This is not a bubble. This is not some backdoor way to get public like kind of it used to be. But this is, you know, something that is here to stay and is going to be an important method for businesses to get public. And therefore, it's good that we're focused on them, and others will continue. Others will be focused as well. SPACs are great for the Barron Small Cap Fund and for Barron Capital. SPACs are a great source of new ideas, as we've been discussing. David and I have made 10 new investments. About half of our new investments over the last couple of years have come through buying into new SPACs. Barron is really set up well to be able to execute in this area. That we have, you know, a very deep research team of about 40 people who all understand this channel and all are focused on chasing down ideas in their sectors when different companies get shown to us. It's actually, there's a lot of logistics and pace that's necessary to be brought to bear, and we're actually a pretty well-oiled machine in how we're able to stay on top of all the different transactions that are coming through the pike and find ones that really fit our criteria. As David mentioned before, there were 65 or so deals that closed last year. We looked at most all of them. And as I mentioned, too, there will be, you know, three times that amount I would expect that will close this year, and I believe we have the capacity to do a good job in looking at most all of those, too, as they come to us. Because we are pretty sophisticated in doing this, we provide a lot of capital. We are considered, both the sellers of businesses and the SPAC sponsors like to have us to advertise that we're an investor in their transactions. We're really sought out to be involved in almost all these deals. And that's great because that means that we're getting proprietary kind of early looks and calls from the lead investment bankers and the SPAC sponsors to explain their businesses to us and see if we want to get involved. So they're, really seeking us out, and I'm more than happy to take them up on their offer. And as I kind of mentioned before, too, the other benefits for Barron are that we really have months to do due diligence and multiple calls with companies and competitors and industry experts, as opposed to in an IPO transaction where very often you really have, a day to make a decision, and you're putting in an order based on impressions, not actually on work that you've been able to do. And we, especially for the small cap fund, which is about $5 billion asset base, we can make meaningful investments. And as I mentioned before, typical investments are somewhere between 25 and 50 million. And SPACs, the 10 SPACs we own make up, I think, 13% of our portfolio now. So this does matter to our, we are finding important ideas for our fund. And over time, this channel will make up a bigger portion of our fund. Hop in there, Davey.
Just if I could, just to bring that point home on extensive due diligence, just a real-world, real-time example, Cliff, I think would help. There's an IPO that we're looking at that I'm not going to go into names or just reticent to share, but the EBITDA reported in 2019 was $119 million. In 2020, it was $200 million. So that's a huge jump in EBITDA in 1 year. And what they are pointing us to for valuation purposes is an acquisition-adjusted EBITDA of $265 million. So from $119 million to $265 million in 2 years or a year is remarkable. Yet, during our 40-minute, investor management meeting, we weren't trying to understand the business better and the competitive advantages. We needed to do a follow-up call, which we were allocated 30 minutes, to really dig into those numbers. Contrast that with the Janus or one of these pipes or SPACs that we'd be able to invest in, where we'd be able to walk through explicitly the assumptions that management's making, the business drivers of some of the of some of the ramp that they're estimating, and really drill down to rule that whether we believe as a group that the estimates are realistic or optimistic, and those just base our valuation metrics a lot, can be a lot sharper. So it's just a good contrast where. It's very hard an IPO in the short time frame now, especially now, versus doing these diligence and SPACs.
Yep, great. I want to reinforce, too, that we really are, at least for the small cap fund, seeking to find the same kind of companies that we would through investing in IPOs or investing in any other public company. You all have heard our shtick, which is we'd like to invest in high-quality businesses that we think have significant barriers to entry into competition, have great growth prospects. We like the management very, very much and respect them, and we think we're buying them at a cheap or reasonable price and can make a lot of money over a long period of time as those businesses succeed. And we make compounded returns, ideally, in the shares. So that's exactly what we're looking for here. We just are picking through the ones that are coming to us through this channel to try to find, a handful that kind of meet those same criteria as other stocks that are in the portfolio. So that's all the well and good, and let me just raise a couple of areas of concern or things that occur to us that are potential flies in the ointment or issues at the moment that we're aware of and you all should be aware of, too, if you're interested in investing in the space. The first point is that, in my mind, there's too many SPACs that are chasing too few targets, which means that those targets might be able to play one SPAC off against the next and extract a very heavy price or sell their companies at, you know, very high valuation. We're looking to, you know, and you hear very often that there's auctions that companies will, you know, there's five SPACs that are looking to buy the same business, and the seller or owner will hold an auction, and the highest bidder gets to buy that company and merge it into their SPAC. That really is not in our best interest as being a shareholder in the SPAC. We would like to, you know, make sure that the SPACs buy the companies at what we think are reasonable or ideally cheap prices. And also we'd like, you know, the right sponsor to buy a particular business, a sponsor that can stick around and help that company go forward. You know, we do, you know, and, you know, just again to point back into, there's 185 of these as of the end of last year that are looking to make acquisitions this year. And there's many, many more that are going to be underwritten also that are going to be looking to make acquisitions, and therefore the amount of, you know, you'll have hundreds of entities, 250 entities out trying to buy companies. Standardly about 200 companies come public a year, and therefore, you know, and you still have a lot of, we'll still have a lot of IPOs, but it's just the supply and demand might drive up the price of purchase, which is would not be something we would shy away to invest in companies that the SPACs have to pay too dear a price for. The next point is that many early stage and speculative companies are coming public through this channel and attracting retail investors. To me, this is really kind of concerning in that I don't believe these companies standardly would be public at this stage in their life, and therefore I don't know if they're seasoned enough or ready to stand public scrutiny. And I expect that those share prices are going to be super volatile, and the shareholder base is going to be less institutional and more retail. You know, over the last handful of years, there's been complaints that small companies stay private too long, and the benefits of private benefits go to private equity firms as opposed to public equity investors like ourselves. And maybe this is the counterbalance, that in essence, some private equity or kind of venture companies are now going public, and if you want to play venture in the public markets, you'll have your shot. It's not for me, though. I think it's, you know, to me, this is, these companies are not developed and established enough for me to want to invest in them at this stage. And I'm really nervous that, you know, others aren't going to necessarily pick up on that. And therefore, you're going to have really some wild swings in a lot of these companies as some of them succeed and some of them don't succeed. When we look at the materials that a lot of the companies present concerning their projections as far as their numbers and what they, you know, what their estimates are as far as what they can do in time, we find very often that those numbers are kind of misleading and sometimes a little overly optimistic in our minds. Primarily, and if a company is going to come public in an IPO, the companies are going to be very conservative in how they paint their future and try to meet and exceed expectations. And to me, this is sometimes you're overstating, not understating, what is expected of a business. It's allowed to be done, but I just think that could lead to a lot of disappointment, and or I would just caution anybody from taking too seriously the projections that the long-term projections that many of these companies are making. David, you want to, you know, chime in on that? Because you're kind of in the weeds on a lot of this.
Yeah, and as part of that, you know, every presentation will have a capital structure page that outlines the valuation and what the multiple pays is. But again, you have to really look into the footnotes, and buried in those footnotes are assumptions that sometimes just don't ring true. For example, the bankers assume redemptions of 0%, or that 100% of the SPAC owners roll over their equity, when in the case that's that's not their mandate, or that's not what they're looking to do. They're looking to play a lot of these facts and detach the warrants and have a free option. So that impacts the capital structure where, say, there's 50% redemptions, half the cash that was raised in the SPAC is not going into the pro forma business for the new business. And so that impacts the balance sheet, the leverage ratios, and ultimately the multiple you're paying going in. Also, there's dilution from the warrants that if the stock does work and does trade over 1150 for a period of time, there's dilution coming in the act of more shares given out. There's earnouts as well, which aren't accounted for in a lot of those tables to either the sponsor for executing a successful transaction and seeing a successful company out of the gates. And sometimes sellers get earnouts as well. You really have to look in that. And then there's also fees that are attached to the whole structure given to the bankers that are on the hook for those SPAC shareholders that do roll over their equity. So,
right. So all this is not you just so yes, there's a lot of kind of hidden boogeymen in the backdrop, but just for whatever it's worth, we are sophisticated enough or are capable of understanding all of that, and therefore understanding the dilution and the risks to a company, and we can still find good businesses that are reasonably priced and we can make money on even taking all that into account. But it just takes a sophisticated eye and some real knowledge and understanding of what's not so obvious to understand what you get yourself into. And the last point, which David, kind of just alluded to, too, the way SPACs are done these days is there's kind of a different class of investor who does the IPOs. And many of them are in the business basically of putting up money to buy an IPO with either the desire to or sometimes the actual mandate that they have to sell their shares once the deal is consummated and hope to make money if the company succeeds on the warrant portion that they can detach and hold on to. And what that means basically is after a deal is done, lots and lots of the capital structure is for sale or the shares outstanding are for sale. People like us, or institutional investors need to kind of come in and scoop those up where the stocks kind of dip out of the blocks. And, that's just something else that causes selling pressure on deals after they're done. And with so many more deals expected to close this next year and it to be a little confusing on which company, what one company is versus the others, I know there's just going to be, a lot of clutter and confusion, which is going to cause some of these stocks that aren't in these hot sectors to kind of maybe get off to rocky starts. That's actually something we consider in making our investments. We're hoping to, if we like a company a lot, but suspect that there's going to be stock for sale, significant stock for sale post the closing of the transaction, we'll kind of save some firepower to try to participate at that point in time. And we've in the past gotten some really great bargains and were able to buy a big portion of our position by doing just that. So again, that's kind of a sophisticated move, but it is something that unnerves me a little if so many SPAC transactions are going to close this year. Where's all the money going to come from to take out those initial investors? With that, I think that kind of concludes the our little presentation. And Dave Judas, I think that would be great if we had any questions from the audience and that we can handle now, or we can take after the call ends.
Sure. No, Cliff, we've had a lot coming in, so I'll get to those. And thank you, and David, lots of opportunities, advantages, and certainly some risks to be aware of. But let me try and paraphrase. We have a bunch of questions. So the first one, seems like you've had some success with a variety of sponsors and SPACs. What are the key characteristics you favor in those sponsors and look for?
Davey, I'll start with that, but you can pop in
too.
Yeah,
you start and I'll fill in.
What we really like is for the SPAC sponsor to be, a real expert in the company or the industry that he's buying that his SPAC is purchasing, and that he could, that person can have, a strong involvement in the company post-merger. David mentioned a couple of transactions, one Clarivate where the sponsor actually took over as the CEO, another, Hutz, in which the sponsor really brings a lot of sophistication to a family-oriented business and we think can help manage that company much better. Another one I would highlight is a company we own called Vertiv, in which Dave Cote was the sponsor of the SPAC. Dave was the former chairman of Motorola and of Honeywell, and a crazy successful industrialist business that ran a company that succeeded very significantly under his watch and has a great reputation as a manager and a business owner. So his involvement in Vertiv, which is kind of a sleepy industrial business providing equipment and services to the data center industry, Dave is overseeing and helping that company run that business better and overseeing their acquisition program and management program, and we think he will have a very significant role in the performance of that business and also the performance of that stock, because his involvement really makes investors like ourselves much more comfortable investing in that company. Dave's right-hand man, actually, is the sponsor of Juniper, which I mentioned before, which is buying Janus International, and to us it's a similar type of play where we're investing with a sponsor that we think is a great operator and will help the operations greatly of the company that he's acquiring. So many of the SPAC sponsors are kind of conduits, or they're famous business guys who people know and respect. But basically what they're doing is raising capital and finding a business for others to invest in. Well, I don't really need – I can find businesses to invest in. That's what that's what we do for you all. So I don't need a third party to necessarily do that for me. What I do like is when that third party can actually help run that business and make it more successful and help its share price grow beyond what it would do outside of his involvement. So that's the kind of sponsor and relationship between sponsor and acquired company that we're looking for.
Okay, great. Yeah. No, thanks for that insight, Cliff. And
cool.
For the next question, how do you decide if you want to invest in a PIPE or just buy shares of the SPAC outright?
I'll take that too, Davey, but whatever. I mean, as we were saying before, almost always, three-quarters of the time, a PIPE is now being done alongside a transaction, and we are shown those PIPEs and can consider investing in them when we get to see the target after it's identified by the SPAC. We need to really kind of be blown away to do the PIPE, meaning we really want to get a very, very favorable price. We want to ideally have kind of our fingers in the pie with the terms and making sure that we're comfortable with all the terms of the transaction that are favorable to us. And we also are doing that when we want to, really put significant amount of money to work. It's great to be able to circle a portion of that or all of that or a portion of that up front in this kind of transaction. When we commit to the PIPE, we don't fund until the actual deal is closed. So, again, it's 3 or 6 months later is when we actually put the money up. So we're not out of pocket any money and there's no opportunity cost. But we are obliged to invest when the deal closes. So, very often these days what we're doing is putting some money up, unless we think it's a super hot space and the stock's going to run away from us, we'll make half our investment in a PIPE and then look to make the other half of the investment down the road at a, you know, when the company is after the deal closes or shortly when the deal closes into that period of, you know, digestion or indigestion that I was trying to explain before.
Okay. Great. Next question. Why not invest in the IPO either for the Barron Small Cap Fund or for those of us on the call that might be looking to do so for clients?
Well,
I can take the first part.
Yeah, go for it.
I think it's just our nature that we don't think it's appropriate for our shareholder base to be investing in a blind pool. We invest in businesses for the long term, and you know, while we might like a sponsor and respect their background and business acumen, it's just, you know, again, not it's not what we do is investing in a blind pool. So we rather wait for that company, that sponsor, to find an acquisition in a business that we like that we would typically invest in and go from there.
Correct. And you know, just in others at Barron, or so there are other, are some other funds that are investing in the IPOs when they really like a sponsor very much. And if you do that, you maybe have a leg up in getting a better look into a PIPE or something. But so it's not, you know, I'm not saying that's the, our approach is the end all and be all. And for people on the phone who are investing in their, you know, looking to invest in PIPEs in their own right, I have nothing against investing, you all participating in the IPOs. Many of them have worked out great. And many of the sponsors are really credible and capable, and you know, and so I think, and standardly, you would, you know, have the ability to, if you buy it on the IPO, sell your stock or you know, get your money back if you don't like the deal that they're doing. Or so I'm not against it for others. It's just not kind of consistent with the charter of what we do. Same thing with speculative businesses. I have no problem with others investing in, you know, some of the exciting speculative companies or, you know, real or early stage businesses that are coming public through this channel. Again, that's not what we do for the Barron Small Cap Fund, and therefore I don't want to change our stripes just to, you know, just because it's a PIPE that's, you know, is early stage. We just don't do early stage.
Okay. Next question, I think we've answered some of this. Is the fund buying SPAC IPOs? Is it buying SPAC after letters of intent? And is the fund holding the companies after the closing of a deal?
Yeah. I mean, we're not doing IPOs. We're primarily getting involved either in a PIPE or buying shares after the letter intents are kind of before they're announced, but because we're shown them kind of in a private form before they actually close, given the opportunity to invest in them before they close. So that is the time where we're investing. And our goal is honestly to hold the, of course, we're any investment we're making, we're looking at like any other investment that we own for the fund, which we're hoping to be long-term shareholders in those companies. You know, at the Barron Small Cap Fund, we have very low turnover. Our average hold period is, you know, is over 5 years. And I believe that many of the investments that we're making in, you know, through this SPAC conduit, you know, we'll end up owning for you know, 5 or 10 years as well, as long as the companies continue to perform and grow, and we think we can make good returns in those stocks. You know, if the business, on the other hand, is something that, you know, isn't developing as we would like it to, or we become a little disenchanted in it, or have other things that we like better after owning it for a little bit, we're not opposed to selling, and then we've done that. But, you know, we go in with the hope that we're finding long-term investments for the fund like we would in an IPO or any other new investment we make.
Okay, great. Another question came in. I'm just going to paraphrase a little bit, but it's essentially saying that SPACs are akin to IPOs, except perhaps more expensive and inefficient. Are bankers' fees and warrants essentially expensive replacements to the IPO fee structure? Do you think this is part of the listing process or the reason the number of public companies is shrinking? So there's a lot in there, but I don't know if you could address any of that, Cliff or David.
I'll take the first part, Cliff, and,
yeah, sure.
And chime in,
please.
But I think we're coming into this process eyes wide open, and that there is dilution in, you know, in the SPAC process via warrants and earnouts and sponsor promotes. But we account for that in our valuation and our, you know, estimates, and fully understand that the key here, like Cliff said, and we've mentioned on the call, is that there's value from a target becoming a public entity from either the sponsors' continued engagement or the SPAC's use of cash. And so we really try and drill down on those aspects to find those companies that can offset that and make great returns. And we've been successful in doing so, and I think we'll continue to be, because we understand the process and what we're looking for and how the kind of the SPACs are set up.
Cool.
Okay. We got another question here on, looks like a particular SPAC, LGVW. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts that we can offer on that.
Dave, that's Longview. We met with that company as it came public. Longview is a
right.
It was a company that did a SPAC that a deal that came a couple months ago. The sponsor is an investment firm, friends of ours who run a investment management business. Smart people. They're acquiring. The SPAC is acquiring a really very cool medical products company. It was David and my view that the company was a little early stage and unproven and a little too speculative for us, so we passed on the investing in the pipe and or the public stock at the time. The stock's kind of up from 10 to 20, so obviously a dumb move on my RBF so far, but one of the other funds at the firm actually did make an investment in the pipe, the Discovery guys, so good for them.
Right, and so everyone's on the same page, this is a business that was handheld sonograms, which, again, the utility and the, you know, can certainly benefit, the world can certainly benefit from that. Just think about emerging markets and, you know, Africa or anywhere where you can, you know, rural hospitals can use handheld sonograms. It's a really cool product, but the diligence we did, we didn't get comfortable in the competitive advantage, or there were a lot of other products out there. And like Cliff said, it was zero revenues with an aggressive ramp, and just couldn't get comfortable at this stage to invest.
Right. Again, not so much our thing, but on the other hand, our Discovery Fund, which really does invest in kind of earlier stage and a little more speculative businesses than we do in the Barron Small Cap Fund, did make an investment and kind of fits their mandate.
Very cool product.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, maybe we can squeeze in a couple of more before we wrap it up. Did you guys invest in any SPACs prior to 2020, and are there any required holding periods, or can you sell whenever you want?
As we showed on chart on page 9, we presently have 10 investments now, 5 of which we made those investments in 2019, and 5 we invested in 2020. We have invested in SPACs 10 years ago. I mean, this is SPACs have been around for a decade or more. The quality of the company that came public through SPACs was much lower. Sponsors were much lower. The dilution was much higher. The sponsors were less capable. The dilution was much higher. The SPAC deals themselves were much smaller. So it wasn't, it was never a big way for us to find new investments, but we really have been monitoring developments and SPACs for over a decade now. We did have some investments back prior to 19 as well. And then concerning our involvement, if we do a pipe, we're going to be restricted for 3 months after the deal closes from selling those shares. If we buy SPAC shares outright, there's no, they're freely tradable, and therefore there's no restrictions on us. But again, as the point I'd love to make is that we've done a lot of work on these companies going into the transactions, and therefore it's not we're not going we're you know we're really not planning on, and unusual if we were to want to sell our holdings in a short period of time after making the investments. We're kind of making large investments in businesses and companies that we really like and stocks we really like. We're kind of hoping to own them for a long period of time, and therefore for us to have our hands tied for maybe a three-month period of time is no skin off our back.
Right. No, that makes sense. Last question. You said the holdings are around 13% now. Is there a number of total SPACs holdings in the portfolio that you would call a limit?
No, not at all. I mean, every year, you know, our fund is, you know, the nature of the small cap fund is we kind of have, again, I have maybe 15% turnover. So every year we're going to have, you know, 15% kind of new names in the fund and 15% of the old names or portions of our old stocks are going to be sold to fund those new purchases. I would imagine that, you know, half, if not, you know, about half of the new investments for the last 2 years has come from SPACs, and that's why that's, you know, it really does equate to 6% 2 years, and then, you know, ideally the stocks appreciate as well. So I would imagine that over time that 12% is going to go to 15%, it's going to go to 20%, going to go to 25%. But again, there's nothing, you know, we've now owned Clarivate since January of 2019, and even though we're highlighting it as a SPAC, it was just, you know, it's a SPAC. We found it as it's a SPAC. Now we invest in Clarivate, and there's no difference between investing in Clarivate or any or regular way IPO or other stock that we'd own. So it's not really it's not really a distinction that holds over time. It's just more of a, we're pointing out how much of our portfolio came through this you know method, just to show our activity and involvement, but there won't be a limit on how much we would own, and it really isn't going to matter how we characterize our holdings over time.
Got it. No, that's cool. That's really helpful. Guys, thank you so much. I think we're out of time for today's call. We apologize if we didn't get to your question, but you can have reach out to your Barron's sales representative, and we'll get you an answer. Any additional questions, you could still submit them to questions@barronfunds.com. And again, we'll have your salesperson, you know, get in touch with you to get the answer. Please note, you can also get a replay of the call. The information within the invite, real quick, it's 800-633-8284, and the code is 219-888-48. I really want to thank Cliff and David for the time you guys put into this, and all the great information in your comments. Thank you. And all of you who dialed in today, thank you so much. Most importantly, we want to thank you for your support and investment with Barron Funds. And this concludes our call. Have a great evening, everyone. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody. Appreciate it. You're listening. Bye-bye.
Take care. Thanks.
We thank you for your participation and ask you to please disconnect your lines.